Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Ruler Podcast, supported by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by the community. I'm not sure exactly who first coined the phrase, the medal factory, to describe British cycling's world-class performance plan, but it's a perfect description of the setup that's dominated cycle sport, especially on the track, for more than a decade. More than 40 Olympic medals, 6 victories at the Tour de France, and a seemingly endless production line of young talent emerging through its Manchester headquarters. Some of the gold has been tarnished by persistent but unproven allegations of rule-bending, even doping, bullying, mismanagement, and a toxic win-at-any-cost mentality. Well, the Medal Factory is also the title of a soon-to-be-published book by the veteran cycling journalist Kenny Pride. Given that the story is so well rehearsed, why did he decide to write another book on the subject?
The initial idea was actually a magazine feature for Cycle Sport, the late lamented Cycle Sport magazine. I had decided that the story of Peter Keane and Chris Boardman had been undertold, or rather underappreciated, or, you know, the coach and the rider and guys who'd been, Peter in particular, I think, had revolutionised, it's not too strong a word, I think, but he'd sort of engineered massive changes in British cycling, you know, from the mid-80s onwards in terms of training and nutrition and the approach to the sport. He worked with Chris Boardman, obviously coached Chris to the gold medal in 1992. That gave him a lot of credibility. Subsequently, he would go on to be the performance director at British Cycling. Had enormous influence. So in the process of researching this piece, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And there were so many people to talk to. Then Cycle Sport was shut down. And I thought, maybe there's a book in it. That is kind of the genesis of the book. But it was one of those situations where you talk to one person, and he says, oh, you should talk to this guy. And then, you know, there would be stories and anecdotes. And it just grew. And that was it.
And a lot of people do feel that sort of Peter Keane's role in the success of British cycling has been underplayed. And that in some ways, you know, Peter Keane did all the hard work and the groundwork. And Dave Brailsford benefited from that and took the glory.
Yes and no, actually. That's sort of... But not quite. I think, you know, Peter's approach to the sport and the way he kind of set up the world-class performance programme, Team GB effectively, was different from the way that Dave Brailsford approached it. So certainly Peter laid down, you know, the foundations and but everybody I spoke to, I suppose that was one of the interesting things, like one of the curious things, that Dave changed British cycling. Everybody that I spoke to said it took off after Dave. Now, whether or not that was Dave or whether or not that was the money that came in after that point is moot. It's probably a bit of both. But Dave Brailsford had a big influence on British cycling too. But he couldn't have done it without Peter. He wouldn't have built the foundations of British cycling. But what he did with it after Peter had kind of started the process off was something that people will tell you that Peter couldn't have done. So they kind of needed each other in a way.
And as you say, he came with a lot of money, or his arrival coincided with a lot of money. But money which came with some strings attached as to what it should be used for and what the results should be.
Yeah, in between, I mean, Peter had drifted in and out of British cycling from, say, the mid-80s when he was coach, you know, and then he started coaching the Pursuit team, you know, in the late 80s. But he was never fully integrated into British cycling, but he was very close to it, so he understood what the problems were. And in between, actually, his work as an academic and working full-time for British Cycling as head of performance, he went to work in assessing applications for grants that came in from different federations. So Pete knew what needed to be said and done in order to get a grant. The understanding is that you would get funding on the basis of a credible programme, not in terms of medals. That's one of the kind of myths. You only get money if you get medals. You only get money if you present a programme that looks like a credible pathway to getting medals. That if you don't have a programme that people will assess and say, yeah, that looks like, you know, you've got the coaches, you know, and you hear it a lot, actually, in amongst all the coaches talking about pathways. You know, we need pathways, we need clear pathways and processes and programmes. That's the language of modern sport, you know. And if you don't have those things in place, if you know, we won 5 medals before, give us money, that's not going to work. That doesn't work, you know. There's no guarantee. Medals 5 years ago, or whatever medals that you won, will not guarantee future medals. You need to have something in place that shows you, that shows the authorities, or, you know, whoever's dishing out the money, how you're going to provide, you know, how you're going to find the athletes, coach the athletes, prepare them, you know, what do you need, materials, what program. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, it's not just about medals. But the funny thing is that a well-structured program often leads to medals.
But also they spotted the opportunity that actually there were medals to be won in track racing, whereas it would be harder to deliver any kind of logical pathway in road racing, because road racing is so unpredictable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was Peter. Peter was definitely about the numbers and about, you know, steps and calibration and measuring and, you know, data and metrics and tyre pressures, air pressure. You know, I mean, Peter measured everything that could be measured, you know. And certainly the chaos of, you know, a scratch race or a Madison was just, you know, there was no point. So if you don't have a lot of money, then you put the money into an area where you think you can, you know, you can best exploit your knowledge, which is pretty much what's happened.
And then, of course, after the arrival of Dave Brailsford, we really moved into the area of marginal gains, you know, the round the wheels and burning the secret skin suits and the Chris Boardman's secret research establishment. How much of that, frankly, was a load of bollocks?
I think the phrase marginal gains was rarely heard until after the success arrived. And so British Cycling turned out to be a fantastically successful sports team, Britain's most successful sports team ever. And it still is, you know. And so all of a sudden there was a huge amount of media interest. And in order to make British Cycling look attractive and clever and more like a business than necessarily a sports team, then they came up with this phrase, marginal gains, which was then kind of retrofitted, if you like, onto everything that they had been doing for the previous 8 years. It certainly didn't, you know, nobody was talking about marginal gains in 2000 or 2004. In fact, I don't even think MD was talking about it in 2008, until after they had won. Yeah, so it was a great marketing phrase, and in that sense, it deserves some credit, actually, because all of a sudden there were business leaders sort of knocking down the doors, and British Cycling was held up as an exemplar of, you know, how sport and how some businesses could be run. And so marginal gains is exactly the sort of phrase that would appeal to newspaper editors, business leaders, you know, that they could all quote and chuck about at each other because it sounded like it was hip and sporty and, yeah, it was a buzzword.
And in retrospect, was it always going to be really hard to try and run effectively a commercial operation like Team Sky using some of the same people and some of the same premises and some of the same logistics as British Cycling?
Yes. I don't think there's no doubt about it now. I mean, looking back, you just think, my God, what were they thinking? You know, that's insanity. But at the time, because it was all new and people were giddy and successful and excited and, you know, untouchable, and they could do, no, you know, all those things, you know, we can look back now and go, my God, that's madness. But at the time, nobody was making too much noise about it. It's hard to be hard on them, if you see what I mean.
Rightly or wrongly, I guess, when people look back at this era of British Cycling, both, you know, British Cycling, the organisation, and British Cycling in general, it will be tainted by two things. One is the whole jiffy bag and Richard Freeman story, and the other is Shane Sutton. What's your take on both of those, having spoken to so many of the people involved? Take your time.
So what's my take on a scandal that nearly destroyed a sport? Scandals, multiple. I think hindsight's a wonderful thing.
It's pretty hard to kind of summarise. There are so many elements and factors that feed into it. Though I think there was a lack of leadership at senior management level, and they kind of bottled it, I think, and failed to take some tough decisions. Again, easy to say in hindsight. Famously, there was the Peter King report. Peter King, Roland Keane, but Peter King, the former chief executive, was asked by the then chief executive, Ian Drake, to carry out an inquiry, an internal report, into allegations of sort of bad behaviour and inappropriate behaviour, which included that, you know, bad behaviour by Shane Sutton and Dave Brailsford after the London 2012 games. Peter King, who was kind of well known inside Manchester, he was still about in Manchester, he was still a figure that staff and riders would have been comfortable with. Peter King compiled a report and delivered it to Ian Drake in November of 2012. And in the report, there was 7 or 8 bullet points, and it said Shane Sutton should probably be, his behaviour should be monitored, and perhaps he should sort of be moved slightly away from a sort of daily interface with riders and work more with the senior coach and staff. There was a suggestion made that Dave Brailsford should be moved on as head of performance at British Cycling, because by that point, Sky was taking over the world, basically. I mean, that was 2012, so they had won Paris-Nice, Tour of Romandie, the Tour, Dauphiné. You know, Wiggins and Froome had done the business at the Olympics and the time trial. The suggestion was that perhaps Dave Brailsford should be asked to move from his position at British Cycling.
And what happened to that report?
It was discussed at board level, and the suggestions were never really they just weren't implicated. You know, they weren't carried out. They weren't carried forward. And I'm not quite sure why, except to note that British Cycling had just had its most successful season ever, most successful year ever, from the World Championships, actually, the World Track Championships, the London Olympics, all the road racing in between. First ever British winner at the Tour de France, the whole thing. And so somebody, the board at British Cycling, was going to have to ask Dave Brailsford and Shane Sutton basically to back off. And crudely, I suppose, you know, they kind of bottled it. Which, you could argue, is understandable, because they had just delivered the most successful cycling season in the history of British cycling. So who on the board of British Cycling was going to turn around to them and say, thanks very much, clear your desks?
In retrospect, may have been a missed opportunity then.
It certainly looks like it now. But again, you know, if Jess Varnish hadn't spoken out in 2016, in March 2016, we would never have known about the King report. We would never have known about, you know, none of this would have happened, arguably. They knew there were some problems, but again, there was a bit of a failure at senior at board level. At the time, you can understand it. You can understand it why they kind of went, oh, well, you know. And who knows about the politics that operate at board level in an organisation, you know, like British Cycling. You know, there are alliances, internal politics, rivalries. Brian Cookson, who's not necessarily Dave Brailsford's biggest fan, he was the president at the time. But by 2013, going into 2013, he was already thinking about launching a bid to become president of the UCI. So Brian didn't have his eye on the ball, you know. I've no idea, really. But missed opportunity, easy to say that. But yeah, that's what it looks like. Well, one of the things I think in the book that I do talk about is the fact that British Cycling went from being an amateur organisation that was basically like a mom and pop store to something that was fantastically wealthy. So if you like, there was a lot of money being invested in an organisation that maybe wasn't managerially set up to cope with it. And again, to be fair, they were making up as they went along, because there was no other organisation. Cycling had never been given that amount of money. The processes and the people and the coaches, the managers, everybody was box fresh. And they couldn't really look anywhere else for an organisation to copy. I mean, you know, there was still the three A's, the Amateur Athletic Association. it was an amateur organisation that had been given enormous wealth, and they were making it up as they went along.
Olympics in Tokyo are coming up pretty soon now. Do you think British cycling is going to be as successful as it has been in the, for the past couple of Olympic seasons?
I think it would be a miracle if it was. If only for the reason, I mean, even if the staff had stayed substantially the same, which it has, actually, when you drill down into it. But given the run that British cycling's been on really since 2004 in Athens, and then spectacularly in 2008, 2012, 2016, how can any nation sustain that? More than that, everybody else is kind of woken up. You know, everybody else has sort of looked to the UK or GB and thought, okay, well, what are they doing? What are they using in terms of, you know, track materials and training and even just the way that, that people attack the team pursuit or pursuit events now? You know, it's completely different from the way it was 20 years ago or many years ago, would that be 16 years ago or whatever. So everybody's cottoned on, and so Britain would have a hard time maintaining that position anyway. So I'd be astonished. As far as the staff changes go, Stephen Park, he replaced Shane Sutton, effectively. I have a hard time thinking that, that, you know, if you look at the legacy of, you know, Peter Keane, Dave Brailsford, Shane Sutton, you know, if you look at the Olympics that those guys prepared British teams for, Stephen Park will do an astonishing job if he manages to replicate what those guys did. And he's the main change, I think, because if you look at the coaches, Jan van Eyden, Ian Dyer, Paul Manning, they're still in place. You know, they were the coaches that, that Shane worked with and that Dave Brailsford worked with, and they're still there, so that hasn't really changed. The big changes in British cycling post the Sutton inquiry or whatever have taken place on the non-glamorous side. Good old-fashioned grassroots British cycling. My fear or suspicion is that, that British cycling has been is now run by sports administrators rather than cyclists, which again goes back to something I said earlier, that back in the day they were basically amateur enthusiasts who were cyclists first and, you know, had no clue about sports administration or sexual politics. And now there are far fewer of those people in British cycling. Whether that has an impact, you know, further down the line, I don't know.
Kenny, thanks very much indeed for talking to us. And Kenny Pride, The Medal Factory, is out soon, I think, on Pursuit Books, isn't it? Later this month.
February the 20th, available from all good bookstores.
Kenny Pride. This is the Ruler Podcast, supported by Lacquer, bicycle insurance powered by the community.
I'm Mark Williamson, and I've been a Lacquer customer since the start of 2019, so about 8 months now. So I was on this new bike and stopped off at a coffee shop at a hotel just to send a few emails and make a call. Came out and found someone had taken off the headset at the front. They'd cut the braking gear cables, they'd unscrewed the handlebars and stolen the bars and shifters. Lacquer were phenomenal, actually. I was blown away by both the immediacy and the kind of helpfulness of the support. They seemed keen to help, and it was just a remarkably hassle-free experience. I couldn't have been happier with the service, despite being incredibly frustrated that somebody had decapitated my new bike.
So it's time to catch up with Ruler's Desire editor, Stuart Clapp. Stu, what have you been up to?
I've actually been recovering from pneumonia, which hasn't been the most beautiful journey I've ever been on. You know, when I spoke to you last, I said I had a cold. Well, I decided I'd better go to the doctors. And it turns out I actually had pneumonia. So that explains why Lemsip wasn't touching the sides, Ian. But right now, I'm just chilling at home with my dog.
Are you recovering then?
Yeah, I've actually started riding again. And you know when people go to you, oh, you should take it easy when you got a cold, right? I'm brilliant at giving advice. I bet every cyclist, listen to this, can give fantastic advice to their mates. But when it comes to them, right, you can't take heed of your own advice. So I thought, who shall I ask? Who's going to be good at, like, giving me advice, right, on tips from recovering from illness and getting back into training? Because it's not like I'm racing or anything, but, you know, you want to be fit, don't you, right? So I thought, who can I ask? And I thought, Dr. Adam Blythe will be the perfect person. So Adam has coached me back into training. I mean, what better person do you want for medical advice than Adam Blythe?
Something tells me that Adam Blythe is probably not the best person to go to for medical advice.
Do you know what? He was actually really good. Because, you know, he's done a bit of riding, hasn't he, over the years? And you would kind of imagine someone who's had like a 10-year pro career to have had the odd cold once in a while. And, you know, bearing in mind that like where they are in terms of their fitness is like way beyond normal people. And then they're going to pick up colds all the time. Like there's that old adage of there's a fine line between an informed cyclist and a sick one. You know, you're constantly pushing your body to the limits. I think mine was mainly because I had a cold and then went out, proper out. And I think I ruined myself. So yeah, when you have got a cold, rest up.
Ruler 20.1, the current issue is in the shops and it's dropping through people's letterboxes. And in the current issue, the desire section is full of gravel. Gravel bikes.
It is full of gravel bikes, yeah. And the location for this shoot I actually found whilst out on my gravel bike. You know, sometimes we go a little bit abstract, don't we? Like with desire, and we try and, you know, we go and shoot it with supercars and things like that. But this one was actually very, there's a story behind it. And I was actually with one of the twins that's modeling in it, Tom and Mark Barningham, who model in it. I was with them on our ride, was with Mark or Tom, I don't know which one, they're twins, I couldn't tell them apart. But we were out riding and we stumbled across this mill and thought, oh, we'll come back here and do the gravel shoot here, which is essentially what a gravel bike does. You know, it sort of opens up your road a little bit more. You know, you can take a wrong turn and go down a bridleway or something and end up somewhere, and that's precisely what happened, which is why, you know, we've got this venue. But it's really cool, we've got some wicked bikes in there, and it was really nice having twins in a shoot, because, you know, that's we almost missed the trick, like, and not had them together in a picture. And I think actually out of all the photos that Benedict Campbell's done for Desire, I think one of my favorite pictures he's ever done is in this shoot, and it's the one of them in the laser helmets next to this great big, I don't know, part of the old mill that was there. It looks proper you know, like Chernobyl type thing. Yeah, it's pretty cool, like urban exploring, I think they call it. But yeah, it looks wicked. So yeah, we've done that, and it's got some nice bikes in it, including mine. And yeah, it's quite exciting. They've got the Look 765 gravel RS, which looks really cool. Benedict shot it in this mound of rubble, and I imagine there's quite a bit of asbestos kicking around, but we'll gloss over that bit. And the TTC Flexi, they do a road version of the TTC Flexi and a gravel one. We did a gravel one in there. My Factor, which, you know, if you've got a nice bike, I might as well put it in. You know, it was like, it's quite obnoxious for a gravel bike, mine.
And the other one that's in there, which has been attracting a lot of attention, is the Colnago gravel bike.
Yes, I thought you'd get to that. Yeah, yeah, that's kind of the lead bike in the feature. It's sort of the opening spread and then gets a double page spread after it. But it's such a pretty looking bike, and actually something that I didn't think Colnago would ever do. I didn't think they were ever going to do a gravel bike, because, well, it's just Colnago, isn't it? They're quite traditional. And when they did, it was like, whoa, yeah, it's quite something. And it was quite quite an attraction at the Ruler Classic back in November.
And do you remember back at the Ruler Classic, we actually had a conversation with Luke from Colnago on the stand?
We did, yeah. And you know what? That's quite something, because I remember very little from the Ruler Classic. But yeah, I do. Yeah, Luke is a legend. Yeah, we did. And Luke can probably tell us a little bit more about it. But yeah, we're here on the Colnago stand, and there's a couple of new bikes here which I haven't seen. Obviously the new gravel bike. So the Prestige won everything, cyclocross bike. Why is this different to having a cyclocross bike?
Okay, so our new gravel bike, the G3X, differs from the Prestige, our cyclocross model, by having larger clearance for tyres, longer top tube, and a different geometry for that, so you can kind of hit any type of road, gravel, off-road, wherever you fancy going. This model's available as a frame set or complete bike, two color options, so it's kind of ready to hit the trails wherever you wish to go.
And have you had a bit of a sort of demand for gravel bikes? Have people said that we'd like one? Yeah?
Yeah, there's a big demand for gravel now. So we kind of thought it was right to put our mark on this model and offer it to people.
It's nice, isn't it, Stuart?
It looks really nice. The one that's on the stand is like a green colour. Like a
Metallic green.
I had a Kona Lava Dome in the mid-90s, a very, very similar colour to that. It's got like a eggshell blue seat post, which I really like.
And the graphic on the frame as well. So it really kind of sets it off.
Yeah, it's a very good-looking bike. Very, very good-looking bike. But there's also something else that's new here, right, which was just been unveiled, which is the E64. So I walked around a couple of times, and because I've actually been, I'm really into e-bikes. I haven't got one, but I know that at some point I'm going to have one. And I said, hey, I'm really into e-bikes. And everyone's gone, no, you're not. I'm not waxing lyrical, but I am really quite a big fan of an e-bike because at some point you still want to go riding with your mates and you might not be as fit. And this sort of will take you there. But if I'm going to have one, the E64 looks the nuts.
Tell us about the Colnago e-bike then.
So the Colnago E64 looks very, very similar in appearance to the C64. Other than it's fitted with a motor battery. Now, you will ride this bike generally with the motor switched off, so you ride as a normal kind of road bike, and then you can turn on that assistance as and when you need it on the climbs or just when you're feeling a little bit tired on the return leg.
Is that what that button is, just behind the on the front end of the top tube?
That's correct. So you've got three modes of assistance there.
How many watts is that going to give you? Does it work like that?
It just basically gives you assistance. So whatever you put in, it'll give you an increase of a percentage gain on that.
Oh, okay. Right. That's good to know. For when I inevitably get one. I mean, I reckon I've got another three months. Especially at this rate, the Ruler Classic. Where I'm going, I'm going to need one this afternoon. But yeah, that's great. Thanks, mate. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
And that's it from this Ruler podcast. Catch you on the next one.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.